You're listening to OWW Radio,
the official radio show of OnlineWorldOfWrestling.com.
All right, so here we are, living it day by day. You are the superstar, and he says what she used to always say.
Welcome to this edition of OWW Radio. This is the official radio program of OnlineWorldOfWrestling.com. My name is David, and I am joined today by my good friend Alex. How are you doing today, Alex?
I'm doing well, and how are you doing today, David?
I'm doing great, and we have a really exciting show this week. We're going to chat with the co-executive producer of Memphis Heat, the true story of Memphis wrestling, Sherman Wilmont. He'll be on here soon, but I want you to know what Memphis Heat is available now on iTunes. So check it out if you haven't already, and get ready for a really interesting interview. Alex, so before we bring Sherman on the program, I wanted to get a few thoughts from you on what's going on in the world of wrestling. What do you think about Vince McMahon's return to Raw this past Monday night? It did help ratings.
Well, it's interesting because he's a superstar of the past, even though you may not think of Vince McMahon in that capacity. But he definitely increased the ratings. But I'm a little bit sick of the corporate hierarchy and who's in charge of who. Evaluations on the air. I would like it when they hit 3 hours for the 1,000th show if they just took a storyline in a brand new direction.
Yeah. I always like when Vince comes back. It does kind of raise the excitement level for me. I enjoyed seeing him, and maybe that's because, you know, I've been a Vince fan, you know, for, wow, going almost 30 years. So I was excited to see him back. But Alex, do we need 3 hours of Raw every week?
Personally, I don't. And actually, we'll get into this when we discuss the Memphis Heat documentary, but the Memphis territory had a 90-minute wrestling show, and a lot of promoters said that's the perfect amount of time. I don't think there's anything you can get done in 3 hours that you can't get done in an hour and a half, 2 hours.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you there. Now, I will admit that this past Raw I thought was a decent program, but in general, I'm not crazy about carving out 3 hours every Monday night.
It's a huge commitment. There's a lot of things on television. A lot of people have lives. I don't particularly think this is a great move.
Well, now, in fairness, you know, I TiVo the program and all that, and so even though I TiVo it, 3 hours, it still takes me a good hour and 20 minutes, hour and 30 minutes to get through it. I just think that sometimes when they go to the expanded programs like this, we just get some fluff or some more interviews or whatever that we don't really need.
Absolutely. I mean, I recap the show live every week after Monday Night Raw for another website.
Where can people find that show, Alex?
AngryMarks.com. It's called the Raw Reaction Show. And there's a lot of fluff and a lot of filler, and sometimes good material is crammed in there, but you sometimes have to look really hard for it. If you condense it, maybe you can have a 2-hour show with a lot of good material. I'm definitely not a fan of this 3-hour show, and I haven't met anyone that is.
Well, now, you do that program every Monday as a post-Raw recap, essentially, right? But you're also a big TNA fan. What did you think of Slammiversary this past Sunday night?
Other than WrestleMania, this might have been the pay-per-view I was most excited for this year. They're building a lot of interesting angles, and it looks like a lot of the interesting angles are going to continue throughout the year. TNA's had a renaissance. Hopefully they don't sell out for the quick ratings boost or whatever that will be and continue on the slow course of providing good programming, because eventually the fans are going to catch up.
Mm-hmm. But in general, did you enjoy it?
Yes, it had some very good matches on it. It had some interesting turns and the different storylines that they're producing. And it gives you a lot to look forward in the future. So a very effective pay-per-view in a day where pay-per-views are oftentimes missable.
Well, we talk about TNA on this show a lot. We try to give it fair coverage. And do you think this is the kind of show, this Slammiversary, that people will take note and say, boy, they really have some good young stars. And maybe, you know, this is a promotion that I should watch more often.
Young stars, maybe not. I mean, a lot of these guys, other than Austin Aries, are a lot of guys that have been there for a few years. But they're being presented in different ways. This creative team is trying to present these characters in different ways. So it's been interesting the past few weeks, and sometimes you can shine that old rifle or whatever you have in your closet and make it new again, and I definitely think they're doing that with TNA right now, and I'm very supportive of their product currently.
Okay, let's go ahead and bring Sherman Wilmont on the program. Again, he is the co-executive producer of Memphis Heat, the true story of Memphis wrestling, as it says in the title. Let's go ahead and get Sherman on the program. What do you say?
All right, let's do it.
Well, Sherman, thanks for joining us.
Oh, man, David, thanks for having me on and representing the film. It's a tribute to Memphis Heat that great websites like yours and radio stations like yours have had us on the air, and we really appreciate it.
Well, certainly our pleasure, and this is a really interesting documentary, Memphis Heat, the true story of Memphis wrestling. Sherman, this film is based on the book called Sputnik, Masked Men and Midgets, The Early Days of Memphis Wrestling by author Ron Hall. Let me ask you, why did you decide to make a documentary based on this book?
Well, Ron Hall is a Memphis historian, and he and I have worked on several projects here, mainly music-oriented ones in the past. And we've done several books and CD compilations. And Ron came up with this collection of great old photos, promotional photos, and then we got together another collection of unpublished photos by Robert Dye, a photographer here in Memphis in the late 40s and 50s. And we knew it was a great book, but because of the work we'd done before with Memphis music, there had been a documentary made out of one of the other books we did, and we wanted to take the project on our own to make sure it was done, you know, in a good quality fashion. And so that's why we undertook the documentary ourselves, so that, you know, we knew it would be a great subject matter for both the fans who grew up with it in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, but also for another generation who has never been exposed to it. So we just knew it was a great subject matter, and we just want to make sure it could be as good as possible.
Right, and of course, like we said, based on the book Sputnik, Masked Men and Midgets, that Sputnik is Sputnik Monroe. One of the very interesting interviews that you had in this documentary, you guys did a great job rounding up the really important people from that time period in Memphis. Did he explain why he felt so strongly about his support of the black fans? Because that was something in the documentary I found very interesting.
Yeah, he had, I don't know if it was in the main part of the film, but certainly in the DVD extras, he talks about growing up, and I think he had this may not actually have made the finals or the DVD extras or not, but he had grown up, I think, in Kansas, and there was a African-American woman in his house who kind of raised him, and he was never taught that there was any other way to treat people except equally, so when he got older and he saw racism, he kind of had a kindred spirit in the South, especially with the black fans. In the film, he certainly talks about how important they were, not just to the sport of wrestling, but for him and his crowd. They were only allowed to sit up in the upper deck in the late 50s and early 60s in the Ellis Auditorium. So what he would do is, you know, when he made a big move, he would have to go and look up to what they called the crow's nest, as they called it back then, and get all of his fans cheering for him. Now, he was a total heel. It, of course, in a racially divided time in our country,
yep,
it just drove the fans wild that a white guy was like their hero. It's kind of like Elvis was with rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of breaking through the barriers. This is like late 50s, early 60s. And so It was definitely a kindred spirit he had growing up, but also, you know, it was his fans. He wanted his fans down lower so that he could be surrounded with them going nuts when he went into the ring. So he forced the promoters to let them sit in the white areas of the Ellis Auditorium. Before the whole civil rights movement, and it was very specifically happening here in Memphis, he was integrating the crowds in the wrestling auditoriums, which in and of itself was amazing. But what it did on top of that, it took the rest of society who were segregated in, you know, upper class theaters and restaurants and things like that. And they started saying, well, heck, if the wrestling crowds can be integrated, why do we have to sit in the balcony at a nice theater? And so it really was kind of a linchpin for integrating Memphis in the South.
Yeah, we just did a interview here on OWW with the author of the new Junkyard Dog autobiography, Greg Klein, and he talked a lot about these similar themes in how Memphis and that whole Mid-South territory, of course, down in New Orleans, that whole racial tension back in this time. And I think it's very fascinating how wrestling brought the fans together.
Yeah, I think it's incredible, and I can't wait to read that book. I've been reading reviews about it. It sounds like a real excellent piece. But I think the Junkyard Dog in New Orleans was as popular, or maybe more so, in the 80s as Sputnik Monroe was in Memphis in the late 50s and 60s. You know, Junkyard Dog is still really popular here for his time in the 80s in this territory. I can't even really explain how popular Sputnik Monroe was in Memphis, because he literally had half the population like just revering him as a rock star, and they say he could have run for mayor and won because he would have had all of the African American vote, and certainly a lot of the younger kid, white kids vote, because you know he was a big hero to the young kids growing up in the 50s and time of upheaval in society when things were changing so quickly, and he was like a rock star before rock and roll.
Well, one thing that's very evident from your documentary is how important television was to the Memphis territory. There's an interview with Jerry Jarrett where he basically says 90 minutes is the perfect amount of time for a wrestling broadcast. I think that's fascinating because today, in fact, Alex and I just talked about this, Monday Night Raw is now going to 3 hours. In your opinion, why was Memphis able to make such compelling television in really half that time?
Yeah, I don't know that the time was necessarily the factor, but certainly you gotta lay it at the feet of Lance Russell. To people who've never seen any of the YouTubes of Lance's interviews and Lance on the show, in my opinion, he's the greatest. A lot of people look at Gordon Solie maybe being better, but they're certainly in the same level. But Lance Russell, who was the host of the show here on Saturday mornings in Memphis, and his sidekick, Dave Brown, who's still the number one weatherman in Memphis after about 50 years. Dave was very soft-spoken and was kind of a quiet sidekick, and they lent a lot of credibility to the action in the ring. And Lance was kind of this 70s older gentleman. Older gentleman in the 70s. He was very serious, but he wouldn't take any guff off of the wrestlers. And, you know, he'd let them go on, and finally he would, you know, he'd give back to them just as much, but in a more of a sophisticated way. And he just had his own style of kind of leveling the playing field, and he let the wrestlers who were doing unscripted interviews, they basically were just told, you know, go out there and at the end of the interview, you know, there's going to be a chair flying, and the rest they had to fill in the blank. They weren't scripted, and Lance wasn't told what was going on, so he had to play it straight. And what it did is it made for compelling TV. And what the TV did, it wasn't just the TV show, although it was the number one rated show in here every Saturday morning for probably 20 years or more. It was just a 90-minute commercial for what happened in Memphis at the Mid-South Coliseum on Monday nights. And then the genius thing here, which I think we did a good job, our director Chad Schaffler did a good job explaining, he would take these tapes, Jerry Jarrett would take the TV show tapes, and then do separate interviews for each town in the circuit, whether it was Nashville, Louisville, Jackson, Tennessee, Birmingham, Knoxville, wherever. And so they would use the primary part of the show to set up the matches, and then they cut a separate interview for Knoxville or for Louisville, and saying, on Monday night, you better be at the Coliseum, and then for Louisville. On Tuesday night, you better be at the Louisville Arena, you know. And so, and of course, this couldn't happen today because of YouTube and the Internet, but they were basically setting up matches for the next 7 days by the TV program, and then the wrestlers would jump in their car and drive to Nashville, to Tupelo, to Louisville, Evansville, Indiana, Boot Hill, Missouri, and work, you know, 7 or 8 shows a week, and it was just a genius business plan that Jerry Jarrett had.
Hello, Sherman. This is Alex. I am the co-host here at OWW Radio. I very much enjoyed the documentary. It was very excellent. Did you personally have the opportunity to attend any shows at the Mid-South Coliseum?
Nice to meet you, Alex. Thanks for having me on. I grew up here in Memphis in the 70s. I moved here in 74, and, of course, the TV show is what hooked you in, and so I would go to shows mainly when we got a little bit older and could drive to them in the late 70s, early 80s. and probably it peaked for me right around the time Andy Kaufman came through town, which a lot of people think that was just like one match, but it really went on in Memphis for 6 months to a year. And so it just became this almost never-ending soap opera every week where Kaufman would come back or send a video in or call the TV program on Saturdays. It was kind of mind-blowing because at the time he was a superstar in television, but meanwhile he was either showing up here in Memphis on Saturday for the TV show and then wrestling Monday, or sending in a video he would make from his Hollywood mansion and then coming on Monday. So he was spending a lot of time in this, I don't know if you want to call it hobby or sidelight of his, but it really was an incredible time to be a fan of wrestling. So yeah, Monday nights were a hot ticket here, you know, in that period in the late 70s, early 80s.
When you watch the tapes back for the documentary, for the fans that weren't able to be at the Mid-South Coliseum on those Monday nights, how could you compare the energy in the arena for those big shows? I mean, is there anything you could compare it to?
It was kind of like a rock concert, but it was every Monday night. So there's a level of energy depending on how good or bad the card was. But there's always, going to be at least like a Jerry Lawler versus somebody match, because that was the primary main event. So every Monday night, you knew you were going to get something good. Sometimes you have even, you know, over-the-top stuff like an Andy Kaufman and Jimmy Hart tag team, or, of course, the list of superstars that came through here just goes on and on, from the Stomper to Ric Flair to Terry Funk or whoever. But it was a high energy, and they were always doing weird things, new things, you know, hair matches, wife hair matches, scaffold matches, you know, people come in from underneath the ring. Probably the most unique thing that I remember being at was when Jimmy Hart and Andy Kaufman were having a nonstop battle with Jerry Lawler that went week to week to week. One time, Andy Kaufman had allegedly been burned by Lawler's fireball, so he was burned so badly that he was wrapped up like a mummy, and he came out and wrestled Lawler, and right in the middle of the match, when Lawler was like pile driving, all of a sudden from the locker room, Kaufman comes out, and it turns out that he had dressed up Jimmy Hart in the mummy uniform, and so Kaufman just surprised. It was just stuff like that was going on. So, but anyway, long story short, or short story long, last year when the Grizzlies made the playoffs in basketball and beat
San Antonio.
And then went on to play Oklahoma City. And the games against Oklahoma City were all sold out. It was 20,000 people going nuts because we'd never won a playoff game before. And we took them to the triple overtime. That's the first time since I was going to wrestling in my high school years that I had been in any sporting event that was as intense and as fun as it was back in Memphis in the early 80s.
Hey, if I could jump in real quick, Sherman, I'm actually one of the very few Memphis Grizzlies fans in the Washington, D.C. area, because I come to Memphis all the time for work, and I did have
to... All right.
Yeah, I actually went to one of those Grizzlies-Spurs games last year in that great playoff run, and that was an awful lot of fun. The city really seemed to embrace the Grizzlies.
It was insane, and then the next series was even better with Oklahoma, and we should have won them, and then we would have steamrolled over Dallas, but anyway, you can't rewrite history. But both the Spurs and the Thunder series were amazing, and the energy in the building was like it was Monday nights. And then you'd leave on Monday nights, especially when your hero got screwed and the referee, raised the wrong hand, and then you knew you had to come back the next week, which is what made it so much fun, is you could never stop going.
Speaking of someone that screwed over some baby faces at his time, Sam Bass's death was covered in the documentary. Now, for fans who weren't familiar with Sam Bass's work in the Memphis territory, how important was he in Memphis?
Well, he was a big-time heel manager when I moved to Memphis in 74, and he was Lawler's manager, so, of course, he was pretty important. I probably wouldn't have, just being a young fan, I wouldn't have known at the time how important he was. But, they didn't have a whole lot of wrestlers in the circuit in Memphis at that time. So, they might have like 6 to 10 guys on the whole card. And, he'd be involved in, two or three matches. And he was a great bad guy. I hated him with a passion. So he was doing his job right. But all the people who knew him that we interviewed in the documentary just talked about what a great person he was. And he was kind of just a fun guy, you know. And of course, these guys, one of the things we touch on, they spent so much time on the road together that they got in a lot of hijinks on the road. Of course, back then it was a lot different. You know, there weren't as much like TMZ style 24/7 monitoring of behavior. So, you know, these guys would drink on the way to the next matches, and, you know, they would get naked in the, there's one story of Jackie Fargo, you know, jogging alongside the interstate naked. And, yeah, just kind of Southern cornball, you know, hee-haw hijinks. But Sam was really beloved by all the wrestlers that we talked to.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Jackie Fargo. Yeah, he's a great part of this documentary. Some wrestlers, they really are much larger than life. Jackie Fargo is certainly for one. How easy or hard was it to interview that legend?
Jackie was pretty much the nexus of the film.
Yeah.
Here's the deal. There was Ron Hall's a little bit older. He grew up in the 60s with Sputnik and the tag teams and Billy Wicks. I grew up in the 70s with Lawler and Tojo and Dundee, and Jackie Fargo was towards the end of his career. And then our director, Chad Schaffler, is a little bit younger. He grew up in the 80s, more of like the Junkyard Dog era, you know, and Fabulous Ones, that kind of era. So Jackie was so popular here in the 70s that we probably couldn't have done the movie without getting him in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things is, when we started filming, we had a wish list of people who we wanted to interview, but we didn't even know who was alive, because, you know, this was about when it all started, about 2009. And, you know, since then, there's a lot more information on the internet about, you know, every single wrestler. A lot of them have Facebook pages now. But at the time, we weren't sure who was alive and who was available. And we tracked Jackie down through Jerry Lawler, who, of course, keeps in touch with a lot of these guys. And once Lawler gave the thumbs up to Jackie for us, it wasn't too bad. But we had to send our crew over to North Carolina, where he lives, and that was just some logistical stuff. And that's really how we ended up getting a lot of the interviews. We kind of mapped out a plan where we wanted to get Len Rossi, who's in Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to get Ron Fuller, who, you know, we assumed would be in the Knoxville area, but we couldn't get him. So we ended up going to Handsome Jimmy's wrestling camp, Boogie Woogie, in Virginia. Got Jackie Fargo in North Carolina, and also Billy Wicks, who also lives near Jackie Fargo in North Carolina. So we knocked out a lot of the main guys we wanted to interview on one big road trip, which was great because we didn't have a huge budget for the film when we started out.
Right. Well, that's fun. But you couldn't have done this movie, right, without talking to the King, Jerry Lawler. Of course, most people still see him on Monday Night Raw as an employee of WWE, but he had such an amazing ability to have the fans love to hate him, or he could be loved to loved, or, you know, he could just manipulate the fans to make them feel how he wanted them to feel. How did he make himself the most loved person in the territory, and then when he needed to, the most hated person in the territory?
Now, that's a million-dollar question right there, because he's equally good at both.
Yeah.
And when I got to Memphis, he was a bad guy, but I liked him more as a good guy, and for years he was a good guy, and then he tried to switch, and I had such an allegiance to him as a fan that I couldn't really see him being a bad guy all of a sudden. But I just think it's a testament to how good of a talker he is or was. Just able to switch on a dime, you know, and that's a lot of these guys, their personalities were so good that they could come out, talk to Lance Russell for 5 minutes, and they could be his best friend and talk about how great the people of Memphis are, you know, what a great privilege and honor it is to wrestle in Memphis, the beautiful Mid-South Coliseum, and then literally on a dime turn into a bad guy over one comment or one, you know, one little thing, and then, you know, you knew it was on for 6 months that they were gonna be the bad guy. And that was just part of the fun of growing up here and having that show every Saturday morning. Was one day a guy's, you know, the King of Memphis, and the next day he's the scourge of the city. And I think that's the best that I ever saw was Andy Kaufman, because you know, he could do it and make people so angry that, you know, people were immediately running down to get tickets as soon as the TV show was over.
Explain to us, even today, how big Jerry Lawler is.
It's hard to explain because until the Grizzlies came along, we haven't had any professional sports here except for the wrestling, and it certainly peaked in the 70s and 80s, and it really was the number one event in town. It paid for the Coliseum, and it sold out hundreds of nights there on Monday nights. So Lawler's legacy in Memphis, if he never had been on WWE, he could work here and in the territory every day of every week, you know, and he still does. And that's one of the unique things about Jerry Lawler is, you know, on Monday nights he's on the number one rated cable show in the country, and then Tuesday through Saturday he might be anywhere from Savannah, Tennessee to Bald Knob, Arkansas to halftime at the Grizzlies game. I mean, he has the most interesting life of anyone, and it never stops, and he's one of the hardest workers out there to this day. I mean, he does art shows, comic shows, Grizzly basketball games. He'll open a car lot. He'll do a match at the minor league baseball stadium here, and then he'll, of course, go to the Forum and do a WWE show here with 20,000 people. So he runs the gamut from, it could be 50 people or, you know, or WrestleMania. It must just be incredible just to be in his shoes for a week.
I think a lot of fans, when they think of Jerry Lawler, the local boy, they think of his most famous rival, the Australian Bill Dundee. They were natural rivals. They switched between opponents, world tag team champions together. What was it about their dynamic that made them such a natural fit?
Well, if you talk to them, they say it's because Dundee wanted to be the king, but he couldn't be the king because there already was one, so he was a superstar. And so I think they had this natural rivalry where Bill had come in here with his partner, George Barnes, and they were one of the roughest, meanest tag teams I've ever seen. And then George Barnes left Memphis to go back to Australia, and Dundee stayed. And so that left Bill as a singles wrestler. And, of course, Lawler had already established himself as a huge component of Memphis wrestling. So Dundee and Lawler became natural rivals there. And I think they were both undersized wrestlers, but they both were amazing with the tools that they had, and they could both talk up a storm and bring fans in. Dundee kind of, in Memphis, he cultivated this Elvis persona with rock and roll jumpsuits, and Lawler kind of had that Southern bad boy thing going as well. So, you know, they both appealed to women and to men as just like kind of role models, and they got into so many different kinds of scraps. I think Dundee was involved in the first scaffolding match ever, and so they were willing to do anything, and as I said in the film, they did pretty much everything they ever tried worked. And it's what's really bizarre is they're still battling it out in the ring today. I mean, superstar just got a new knee in December, and he's back in the ring again. So it's pretty amazing how long this rivalry's gone on.
Well, speaking of getting a new knee, Jimmy Hart cut a very famous promo that you included in the documentary, What Do You Do With a Horse That's Broken Its Leg? It is very well remembered. What is it about this promo that you think made it so legendary?
The thing that made that promo legendary is what made Memphis wrestling so popular. Is these guys, as I referenced before, Jerry Jarrett didn't say, all right, go out there and say this, this, and this, and then follow it up with this. He just said, okay, you guys are going to be in a hair match on Monday, so get out there and do your thing. And so these guys weren't playing, like, pretending to be somebody they weren't. They weren't, like, in persona. Every one of these guys, from Jimmy Hart to Lawler to Dundee, they were playing themselves, and so it wasn't like they were acting so much. They were just in their personas when they were on camera, and they were all very eclectic and unusual and really good at what they did. And they were anywhere from Plowboy Frazier to Jackie Fargo's bravado to Joe LeDuc's crazy Canadian shtick to the Stomper, who didn't speak but had his manager speak for him. I think what made that promo so successful, and I'm sure Jimmy Hart just came up with that out of his head is Lawler took that as a personal affront. And I think he really thought, well, I've been, you know, out of the business for, you know, and what was weird about that, he broke his leg. He was out for like a year. Now when you get injured, you know, if you're out for 6 weeks these days, it's very unusual. But Lawler was literally out of the business for almost a year. And during that time, Jimmy Hart had kind of usurped some of his power and his popularity or lack thereof or whatever you want to call it, the draw. And so I think Lawler took that really personally when Hart said that. And so it was meant as a, let's see how angry we can get Jerry Lawler mad. I think he actually got him mad. And I think later in at a match in Louisville, Lawler ended up, I think, breaking Jimmy Hart's elbow or arm or something by doing something a little too strenuous in the ring. So I think Lawler was genuinely angry at the comment. So I think that's what made it such a good promo.
Mm-hmm. You keep referencing how good the television show was. We saw stars from all across the country on the show: Andy Kaufman, Terry Funk, Rocky Johnson, his child, The Rock. So many stars went through that Memphis territory. What does that say about the strength of that television? Because it wasn't nationally broadcast like Monday Night Raw today. It was mostly concentrated in that area. So why did so many stars from across the country come to Memphis?
Well, I think, you know, all of it boils down to money, of course, because on that circuit, they might play Tupelo and make $50, and they might play Jonesboro and make $100. But they all knew if they got on the show and were promoting for a card on Monday nights, if there's going to be anywhere from 5,000 to 10,000 people there, they were going to get a real payoff on a Monday, which, you know, would pay their bills for the week. So for the bigger stars, you know, when they bring in a headliner like a Ric Flair or Terry Funk or Rocky Johnson, it was a sure thing payday. And Memphis was a pretty large market at the time. And then, you know, if you did half of that in Louisville and half of that again in Evansville, you know, you're making pretty decent money. For the newer guys, the guys like Hulk Hogan who came in, you know, before they were stars, it was kind of looked at, and I think this is a tip of the hat to Jerry Jarrett, as a great training ground and a place where you could learn how to wrestle properly, you know, how to give a good promo, and if you were tough enough to go with the grueling schedule that they had, you know, literally getting in the car and driving 400 miles every day and, you know, showing up for work. And so a guy like Bill Watts or Florida Wrestling would send up somebody just to see how they do in Memphis and see if, you know, they can learn stuff and then come back 6 months later and see what they picked up. So I think said a lot about Jerry Jarrett's reputation about training wrestlers and breeding good wrestling and good shows that a lot of young talent was sent up through Memphis. And, of course, a lot of them either were already on their way and Memphis was just a stopping point, but it took a lot of the guys who went on to become WWE stars through Memphis.
Yeah, and there's some great extras on this DVD, one of them being an interview with Hulk Hogan that he does there in Memphis territory. And when you're watching it, you're saying to yourself, I can't believe this guy goes on to be arguably the biggest wrestling superstar of all time.
Yeah, it's like getting in a time machine. And if you just want to trace a lot of this stuff, it's kind of like just being able to look at a greatest hits tape of like the NBA, but of the guys when they were in college before anyone knew who they were, you know, back in the day when they wore really tight shorts and, you know, had funny mustaches and whatnot. But it really is incredible to see how some of these people developed. And, you know, even Jimmy Hart, who when he started, he was basically a glorified valet.
Yeah.
And he would stand in the background and chew gum. That was what he did for the first year. But he was a really quick study. And then by the time he left Memphis, I mean, definitely the greatest manager possibly of all time in terms of the gift of gab. And he was a hot ticket because he was so good at getting people angry at him. And if you got to pay your bills by selling tickets, you know, you're going to work harder at your craft. And those guys all did, whether they were from Memphis or they came through here from other territories.
Well, yeah, there's no question that Jimmy Hart is on anybody's short list of greatest managers of all time. I'm glad you brought him up because when Vince McMahon hires him to go to the WWF at the time, this is essentially the close of the documentary. But you say how the show went on for essentially almost 10 years after this. Why was this the point where your documentary ended?
We ended the documentary with Jimmy Hart going to the WWF because, and when Jimmy Hart left, that was symbolic of what happened to the territories and how they all changed with the rise of cable TV.
Uh-huh.
Now, we could have ended on any number of things, but what that was the first major blow to the Memphis territory and losing Hart. And then they lost Lance Russell to TBS in Atlanta. He went down there. And for me personally, when Lance left Memphis, that was a bigger blow because he was the heart and soul of the promotion. So once other areas had cable TV and could afford to buy the best talent that money could buy,
yeah,
and started poaching every area, and of course Memphis was the strongest, so it lasted as long as any of the others did. And because Jerry Lawler was one of the owners of the company eventually, and he was the big draw here, Memphis lasted longer than others. So basically, Jimmy Hart's leaving Memphis was symbolic for the end of that era of wrestling. And then it changed quite a bit in the mid-80s when WWF got bigger and, you know, there was more pay-per-views and all that. So it was kind of symbolic of the end of that era of wrestling.
Personally, what do you think about Vince McMahon? Because people sometimes, you know, he angers some people in what he did going national, but it seems like cable television would have changed the territory eventually anyway.
Well, that's certainly the opinion of Jerry Jarrett, and I'm not going to argue with him. If it hadn't been Vince McMahon, it would have been somebody else.
Yeah, and I agree.
I don't really have an opinion on it because, for me, you know, it was always a local thing, and I didn't even know it was going on in Louisville. And I always, you know, I personally felt that Memphis was slighted because as a young fan, when I would go to, you know, back in the day, they had 7-Elevens and they had little magazine racks with wrestling magazines in them. And you would go there and you'd read about all these superstars, you know, Billy Superstar Graham and Andre the Giant and Terry and Dory Funk. And they would rank, you know, who's the hot wrestler. And in Memphis, those guys would just come in maybe once a year, and so they were big stars, but they weren't, like, as big as Jerry Lawler. So I would look for the names of the Memphis guys. I'd look for Jackie Fargo or Tojo, and Jerry Lawler would be ranked, like, 19th or 20th in those rankings. And I'd be like, this magazine's got to be wrong. And, you know, little did I know, every part of the country had their own territory, and this was all about who had the biggest publicity machine. But it just, what was going on in the rest of the wrestling world really had no impact on Memphis or the territory. So I don't really have an opinion on what McMahon did, but as an older person looking back on what happened, that was just inevitable, whether he did it or ESPN did it or whoever ended up doing it, somebody would have done it. And you know, it's a lot easier to promote one pay-per-view to a billion people than to do what Jerry Jarrett and them were doing, which was getting out and putting up, well, they weren't putting up posters back then, but they, you know, get out and do the TV show and work the car lot openings and all the little mall openings they had to do to build up a fan base in these small towns, which were the meat and potatoes of their network.
One person that was noticeably absent from the documentary was Lance Russell's co-host, Dave Brown. Was there a reason he wasn't able to be on the documentary?
Lance and Dave, we weren't able to film them specifically for the documentary because of the financial reasons that I referred to. And as I said, this started out to be a $5,000 budget film. And the lion's share of that budget went to that road trip we took with a crew and a sound team and cameramen up to the Carolinas and Virginia. And Lance lives in the Gulf Coast of Florida. And so we basically, it was a decision where we had to decide whether we're going to go interview Lance Russell in Florida or catch Handsome Jimmy, Billy Wicks, Jackie Fargo, Len Rossi, and possibly a couple other guys in Nashville, which we didn't end up getting. But getting all those interviews was like enough to do the film. And then, you know, we couldn't afford to go down to Florida with the crew as well because every day was like a couple $1,000s. So it was unfortunate that our logistics didn't work out, but we had enough of him in the tapes in the film that, you know, we were happy enough with that. And by the time we interviewed everyone else, Lance was referenced enough times that he got the love that he needed in the film.
So what are your thoughts on today's product?
I'm not a huge fan of what's going on today. There's some good stuff going on locally in the area, but it's more of a hat tip to, you know, what was going on in the 70s. I went to a show over in Arkansas back in December that was pretty exciting, and Dundee was there. And one thing that happened, it was kind of a tribute to the Tupelo snack bar concession stand brawl, and it even fooled me because they were doing like a concession stand brawl where they were getting out into the crowd and making a mess. And it was done at one of these armory place.
Okay.
And this guy who managed the armory in his uniform came out and got really angry because they were destroying some of the property in the concession stand. So he got involved in the fight, and people were freaking out because he was like getting in with all the wrestlers. Well, then it turned out that he was part of the show too. And so it was done really well, but that's too far in between most of the matches that I see out there. So there's a lot more preening and prawning out there than I like these days. And a lot of it's done with just looks, and they're not really wrestling. But I guess a personal highlight for me in the last couple of years was when Lawler was climbing the ladder in February of last year on his way up to WrestleMania and almost won the match he was having. And I'm like, this guy's 62 years old and he's body slamming guys half his age. That's just awesome. I mean, if I'm getting out of bed at 62, I'll be happy. So, you know, for me, that's been the most interesting thing that's been going on the last couple of years.
I'd have to say my favorite Tupelo concession stand brawl was the second one, Eddie Gilbert and Ricky Morton versus Onita and Fucci. Always been a big Eddie Gilbert fan.
He's immensely popular to this day. I guess because, you know, for that generation, he was like the Jerry Lawler for his generation. But he's beloved in Memphis and the territory for sure.
The title Memphis Heat seems to have a few meanings. Overall, what does it mean to you?
For me personally, it means, you know, Monday night it's going to be hot at the Coliseum, and you know it has a double entendre with the weather down here. And once you get 6,000 to 10,000 people at the Coliseum, there's not a lot of air conditioning. You know, of course, back then you could smoke in the Coliseum, so it's hot and smoky and humid, and so just kind of had this funk on the matches. But in the wrestling parlance, you know, heat is, as Bill Dundee would say, is heat is when they don't like you. And that's probably what's missing the most from modern wrestling is, you know, they don't really not like you in wrestling now. It's just kind of all a show. But back in the day, they really hate, like, I really hated Jimmy Hart. I couldn't stand him.
Right.
You know, you wanted him pile-driven every Monday night, and that's why you paid money. And you were infuriated when he would do something to cheat, knock out the referee, and then he would wake the referee up just in time to do the countdown and have his wrestler win. And that would just drive you nuts for a week. So that's what these guys were good at, was drawing heat. And, you know, they tried to make Jimmy Valiant, Boogeyman, a bad guy here, but he was so cool and such a rock star that he could only draw positive heat, so that they made him a good guy. And that's, you know, that's a testament to how good he was.
He's a real character, isn't he? The Boogeyman?
Love him. Absolutely love him.
Had the privilege of interviewing him in the past, and it was just such a joy to hear him talk about stories, you know, of his career and all the people he's touched.
Yeah, he old school, you know, came up in the early 60s, and by the time he hit Memphis, he'd been around for 10 or 12 years, so he was already, you know, really, really great wrestler, but just had the charisma. I mean, for me personally, he was a rock star, because not only was he had all the charisma of drawing the fans and drawing the love in the ring, but he was doing records here, and they were playing him on the local radio station. they were playing them more than anyone else. I mean, this was the era of, like, you know, Boston and Billy Squire and, you know, classic rock. And Handsome Jimmy had number one hit here in Memphis on the radio, so he was a rock star here.
If I'm not mistaken, Jimmy Valiant's wrestling school is in Virginia. I think you said that was part of your road trip. And one of the things on my bucket list is I got to get my son down there. He loves pro wrestling, and I thought that'd be a fun road trip for us.
Oh, man, what a cool, cool place. And, yeah, he's just so he's such a great caretaker of the wrestling business with all the memorabilia and the way he wants people to come up there, and they have, like, free shows on, I think, Sundays. He's just a gentleman. He's a great representative of the sport, and couldn't be a nicer guy. It's so great when one of your heroes as a kid turns out to be an awesome guy, and I can't say enough good things about Handsome Jimmy Valiant.
Sherman, tell people again where they can find your film.
You can order the DVD at www.memphis-heat.com, and you can also get with our updates on facebook.com/Memphis Heat. We try to keep up with all the people in the film and what they're doing, if they're doing any matches or any autograph sessions anywhere or any new films or books or whatever. And then our film just came out on iTunes about a month ago, and it should be out on Amazon as a download any day now. And we also do a Twitter, and we're at Memphis Heat Film. So we're all over the internet, and we really, really appreciate what guys like you at Online World of Wrestling do with the history of the sport and you know, documenting it so people who are new to it or want to discover, you know, what happened in the 70s or 40s. Your website is amazing. It goes all the way back to matches in the 30s. It's just incredible.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And, you know, congratulations on a really, really well-done documentary. People should really check out Memphis Heat. It's a great, great film. And it was wonderful to have you on here. By the way, we'll put all that information on our website so people can go to iTunes or the other places you mentioned so they can find it. People should definitely check out this movie. Thank you so much, Sherman, for being here today.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Anytime you guys want to talk Memphis wrestling, we can do it all night.
Thank you. We'll talk to you real soon. Have a great evening.
Okay, you too.
Well, Alex, that was a lot of fun. Great interview today.
Absolutely. Very, very informative. The documentary is one of my favorite documentaries of all time, not just the professional wrestling. And to have some backstory behind the documentary was excellent.
You know, I may have mentioned this to you in the past. I basically came into pro wrestling in 1985, and I was so young, Alex, so naive. I didn't realize Hulk Hogan came from other places. You know, all these other stars came from other territories. I just didn't understand this. And so going back and watching documentaries like Memphis Heat just fills in all those pieces for me. It's just a wonderful way to learn about wrestling history.
Absolutely. A lot of fans today, they got brought up on wrestling from the Monday Night Wars. And while the Monday Night Wars were very excellent in wrestling history, it wasn't always how professional wrestling was presented. So it is good to go back and see, like, the Memphis territory and how they presented wrestling and how this territory presented wrestling, because in the 80s, 70s, 80s, it was all different, a lot of variety. It's very incredible as a wrestling fan to see so many different presentations.
And let's tip our cap to the Memphis territory. When Vince started poaching their best talent, they were still able to promote professional wrestling for almost 10 years after that. So that's pretty impressive.
Not too many territories can boast that. I know Portland, I believe, hung on until the early 90s as well. Memphis did have the benefit of being a smaller but larger town. But, yes, incredible that they were still able to have named talent come through the territory after it had seen its peak.
Mm-hmm. And don't forget to check out the OWW website at onlineworldofwrestling.com for the latest news, analysis, and updates from the world of professional wrestling. While you're there, you can also catch up on past episodes of OWW Radio. You can email us at radio@onlineworldofwrestling.com to submit topics or questions you would like us to discuss on an upcoming broadcast. Also, make sure to follow us on Twitter at OWWCOM. That's OWWCOM to get all program updates and announcements. We will also be posting directly to the official OWW Facebook homepage. By the way, if you like the theme song for OWW Radio, it's by the band Love Seed Mama Jump. The song is called My Superstar. Again, the band is Love Seed Mama Jump. Check them out at LSMJ.com. Thank you very much to Love Seat for allowing us to use their song as the official theme of OWW Radio. Until next time, I am David.
And this is Alex.
And we hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll be back soon with another edition of OWW Radio.
All right, well, that's okay.